All right, well, it's good to be back with you all. This talk, I'm going to be addressing the Islamic claim. This is Islam's claim to fame, if you were to ask them. I mentioned last time they say that the Trinity is Christianity's Achilles heel. I hope I did something to show that's not true. But this is now over and against that, what they think is their winning argument. It's their winning proposition. Namely, that Allah is one. Now, before I explain why they think this is such a winning proposition, I want to tell you something of my own experience getting into Islam and some of what I initially thought would be helpful in engaging Muslims, and how the dawning realization came that maybe I should have put some of my emphasis in a different direction. So I was converted in a context where Islam was very appealing to people, especially people who were disaffected for various reasons. Islam was presented as the solution to what they were told or sold, what they were sold on as being their problem. Now, all the stuff that they were telling people about Islam was a bill of goods. It wasn't actually true. But in that context, I came to faith, and I wanted to be able to evangelize people, and I quickly learned that it wasn't so simple, that I couldn't just tell people the message that I found so gloriously true and expect people to jump at it. I was just telling somebody in the foyer a moment ago, when I went to people and told them, your sins can be forgiven, put your trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, your sins will be forgiven, the response that I got back was, are you calling me a sinner? Now, that's one example. And I would think, well, yeah, I guess, but that's kind of missing the point. At least it's missing where I'm trying to land. And the way I often think of this is it's like me coming to somebody and saying, look, I've got a solution to your financial problems. Here's $1 million. And imagine the person responding back to you and saying, how dare you? Are you calling me poor? And I would think, well, I guess in a sense, you've got a financial issue and this solves it. But you're missing the point when you take offense at this. The point is, there is this issue and here's the solution. Well, I wanted to be able to get over these objections that people had. I learned that it wasn't the case that people would jump at the message. They would have objections, and sometimes the objections are grounded on the fact that they're taking offense to certain things. It strikes at their core values, what they think about themselves and the world and so forth. There are worldview differences between us. And so when I was thinking about all that, I started to think that maybe one of the things that would help me is to take a logic course so I could reason with people. And I'm not discounting that now. I think that's very useful. There are all kinds of reasons why that might be something you might be interested in. Or you could just pick up a logic book and learn what the rules of inference are. What does it look like to make a sound argument? How do you detect bad arguments? All that's very good. But here's what I eventually learned is something that many people overlook, and more, the more I think about this, the more I think this is true. What I should have been focusing on, at least initially, is the whole area of propaganda. Propaganda. We're all somewhat familiar with it, even if we don't necessarily benefit from it as well as we should. We're all, you know, whenever you are inundated with commercials and other, there's all these ways that you're being, when I was in, we were in Arizona not long ago, and we're driving through town, and everywhere I looked, there's a billboard, and there's a guy who basically looks like he was taking over the billboard scene. And it reminded me when I was younger, I got in an accident. Somebody came and hit me from behind, and I was told that I should go see a lawyer. Now, the way this worked out is everything was settled. There was no lawsuit or anything, but somebody was telling me I needed to go see a lawyer just as a matter of formality. And I thought, well, I don't know if I want to go see a lawyer. And my kids said, oh, yeah, they said, call 878-8888. And I thought, what? They had heard this jingle as they were coming up on the radio, where it was constantly advertising this particular lawyer. And it was brilliant, right? It worked. My kids, and that's the number I called because it was the easiest thing to do. Well, there are a lot of propaganda techniques, and people fall for them all the time. One of the propaganda techniques that Muslims are especially good at is repetition. Repetition is where you constantly say something and people become persuaded of it, not because they've given you good reasons for it, but because they've repeated it so often. And one of the things that Muslims will repeat over and over and over again is that their doctrine of God is clearly taught in the Quran. It's simple, everybody can understand it, and it's agreed upon. All Muslims have the same view. And by contrast, what you're supposed to think is the Trinity is not clearly revealed in the Bible. It's not simple, and it's not agreed upon. Now, we're not talking about the Trinity now, but that's how this is set up, and that's how this is supposed to work. You're supposed to think all these things with respect to the Trinity and all these things with respect to Islam. And for years, I would hear this from Muslims, and I used to think it was true. I used to think, okay, yeah, it's clearly taught in the Quran, and it's simple, and it's agreed upon. Allah is one. Over and against those who say there are many gods, and over and against that confused doctrine of Christians who say God is three in one, what does that mean? Right? Our doctrine is clear and simple. The Quran says, what's the famous chapter of the Quran that any Muslim can parrot? It's Surah 112, Surah Al-Ikhlas, where it says, say he is Allah, the one, the self-sufficient. He begets not, neither is he begotten, and there is none like unto him. Okay, that's the famous chapter of the Quran. There are other statements in the Quran that also factor into this. But this is supposed to be clear, simple, and agreed upon. Okay, but now let me tell you what's really the case. One of the things that happened in the history of Islam is, that's not my water. At one point, there was a debate among Muslims about the status of the Quran. How should we think about the Quran? Now, here you're going to have to be a little philosophical with me for a moment. Muslims love to be philosophical when they're attacking the Trinity, so we need to be a little bit philosophical in order to think through their view and raise some objections to it in like kind. According to Muslims, the Quran is different from the Bible in this respect. We say that the prophets were moved by God. God used the prophets to write what he wanted them to write. God used Moses. God used Paul. He didn't override their personalities in the sense of destroying them. He ensured that what they wrote was true and what he wanted them to write, but he used them. He really used them. They were really involved in the process. So much so that I used to do this thing with my kids. I would say, read something from the Bible anywhere. Pick any place, and I'll tell you who said it. And the reason I could do that was not because I've got the whole Bible memorized. It's because you become... I knocked one over. But you become familiar with somebody's distinctive style. Moses sounds like Moses. Paul sounds like Paul. Jesus sounds like Jesus. But all of them are writing under the special providential superintendence of God. So it is God's word in the sense that he's inspiring men to write what he wants them to write. But the Quran, on the other hand, is supposed to be a dictation. You're not supposed to see anything of the personality of Muhammad in it. This is the Islamic account. I'm not saying this is true. In fact, if you just listen to Dr. Smith, you know there's all kinds of problems with all that. But this is their account. The Quran is supposed to be a literal verbal dictation from their deity. So through the entire Quran, there's no distinct personality that's ever in view other than the one personality of Allah. So the Quran is viewed as Allah's speech, his direct speech. Now, if you think this through for a moment, this has certain entailments. If the Quran is Allah's direct speech, literally, and Allah is eternal, then his speech, as an attribute of his, has to be eternal. So for the Orthodox Muslim, it became dogma to believe that the Quran is eternal. The Quran was delivered to Muhammad from the angel Gabriel. Now, by the way, I want you to think this through for a moment. One of the things you often hear from Muslims against the incarnation is that God can't enter into his creation. God is transcendent. He can't enter into his creation. So the incarnation is an absurdity, according to the Muslim. The question I like to ask Muslims in connection with the Quran is, okay, if Allah can't enter into his creation, how then can you say that the Quran is his eternal speech? How did Muhammad get the Quran? Now, what do you think the answer would be? Anybody? If Allah can't enter into his creation, and Muhammad gives us the Quran that's supposedly Allah's speech, how did he get that from Allah if Allah can't enter into his creation? What do you think the Muslim answer is? The angel Gabriel, okay? But think this through. All they've done is kick the ball down the road a little bit, or kick the can down the road. If Allah can't enter into his creation and deliver his word directly to Muhammad, how does saying Gabriel gave it to Muhammad answer that problem? Isn't Gabriel part of creation? How did Gabriel get that word? See, already there's a logical problem here when Muslims argue against the incarnation and for the kind of deity that posits he can't enter into his... Now, when you read the Quran, there's other problems with this. Allah seems to be breaking this rule all the time. There's a story in the Quran picked up from the Bible where it mentions God appearing to Moses in a burning bush. In the Quran, it says he appeared and spoke to him from the right side of Mount Tur, from the right side. So Allah's on the right side of this mountain. So the Quran creates all kinds of problems for all this. But the basic point, not to be forgotten, is that according to Muslims, the Quran is Allah's eternal speech. So here's the million-dollar question. Is the Quran Allah? Now, no Muslim would say the Quran is Allah. Of course, the Quran isn't Allah. But wait a minute, what does that mean? Doesn't that mean now that there are two eternal realities, Allah and his word? And isn't this starting to sound kind of strange? Almost strangely familiar to you as Christians? Now, it's not the exact same claim. There's huge problems for this that we don't have. But don't we as Christians say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God? The same was in the beginning with God. Isn't this the doctrine that's supposedly confusing, not clearly taught in the Bible, not simple, you shouldn't believe it? Now what do we have over here? We have Muslims in their own development of their theology saying something that apes that. Now I say it apes that because there really is a problem here. When we as Christians refer to Christ as God's eternal word, we are saying that he is essentially one with the Father. He's personally distinct, but essentially one. But the Quran is something fundamentally other than Allah. There is a difference, a radical separation between them. You could, you know, carry around the Quran. In fact, there's a story in the Hadith that says that on the final day, when people stand before Allah to be judged by him, it says the Quran is going to intercede for those that recited it during their lives. Sounds almost like a person, doesn't it? The Quran's going to intercede for them. And now it gets even worse. Certain hadiths say that it's going to appear in the form of a pale man. So the Quran is going to appear in the form of a pale man and intercede for Muslims on the Day of Judgment and say, I was his companion in life, and other things. So now you've got this eternal book that's other than Allah that's interceding for people and appears like a pale man. This doesn't sound so simple anymore. Doesn't sound altogether like absolute oneness, does it? But now here's the thing. Now, a lot of Christians will point this out to you, but here's where it gets 1,000 times worse. According to Orthodox Islamic theology, this is true of all Allah's attributes. The attribute of speech is just one attribute of Allah. He has other attributes that are to be distinguishable from him, just like his speech. So every single attribute that you can think of is an eternal reality distinguishable from Allah's essence. I know I'm being a little philosophical and theological, but hopefully you can at least see that there's an issue here. Now, in historic Christianity, although we talk about God's attributes, we recognize that God is ultimately one with his attributes. We don't just say that God has love, as though it's an attribute he partakes of. We say God is love, right? We don't just say that God has light in the sense of, you know, he's knowledgeable, he has knowledge. We say God is light. God isn't distinct from his attributes. There aren't eternal attributes that God somehow participates in. But in Orthodox Islam, that's what they teach. So there's an eternal attribute distinguishable from Allah known as his speech, known as hearing, known as seeing. And so if you were to ask an Orthodox Muslim who knew his theology, he would tell you that there are as many uncreated and eternal realities as there are attributes. One of the things that Muslims sometimes will say is that Allah has how many names? Somebody's heard 99 names, right? These 99 names correspond to attributes. Now, really informed Muslims know that it's not limited to 99. These are just especially important ones. There are hadiths that talk about if somebody memorizes all of them, they'll get paradise. But of course, that has to be qualified, because then you could have some wretched individual just memorizing these things and thinking he's going to go to heaven. So they say memorizing them means inculcating them and living them out in your life and so forth. But the point is, there are supposedly 99 especially important names corresponding to attributes. So there are at least 99 eternal realities according to Orthodox Islam. Now, some of you are probably thinking, I'm being a little bit too philosophical and so forth, but this is the whole point. Muslims are used to getting away with this when they come to us as Christians. They're used to raising philosophical questions with us, and we're not used to thinking through the issues and returning the favor in their direction. And this is why they can get away with the propaganda technique. Allah is one, it's simple, it's agreed upon. Now, I mentioned that there was this controversy that arose. What I didn't tell you is that the position I just told you about is only one of many answers that Muslims have given. This is the standard one that Muslims believe today, but there were other answers that people have given. I'm not going to go through all of those, but the point is, there were factions in the history of Islam that are just as much there as, you know, we have sects in Christianity, different sectarian groups. Some of them are outside of Orthodoxy. Some of them are just different, you know, they're shades of differences within Orthodoxy. But Islam has had its differentiation over time. We know of the major divisions, Sunni, Shia, Sufi, but even within them, there are all kinds of differences. The idea that it's all simple is simply false. Okay, but let me give you one of my favorite ways of bringing this out. So I mentioned, now this, if you all got lost with some of that other stuff, hopefully I can rope you back in with this. You're about to hear a story that I once told this story to a bunch of young Somali Christians. If you don't know anything about Somali Christians, they're an especially persecuted group. Somalians, boast of being 100% Muslim, meaning there are no non-Muslim Somalis. This is their claim. But what does that mean then if a Somalian person becomes a Christian? Well, in order to retain your identity and your boast, you've got to get rid of that person. They're an especially persecuted group of people, but I can tell you, because I know them personally, there are quite a number of them. It's a myth. When a Somalian tells you they're all Muslims, it's a myth. Well, I was once talking to this group of Somalian Christians, and a lot of the young people were listening to the story, and they were just cracking up to no end, and it was delightful to see, because you know, when you're persecuted, and you know, especially if it's by your own family, some of them were telling me stories about how their mother, once they became Christian, said, "If I ever see you again, I'll kill you myself." Young girls, I met twin girls that had a great relationship with their mother, became Christians, and their mother told them, "If I ever see you again, I'll kill you." So there's not a lot of smiles on their faces a lot of the time. So when I was able to bring a little bit of cheer to them and they could see something of the absurdity of the Islam they left, it was a special joy to me. Well, remember that chapter I quoted for you earlier? Say he is Allah, the one, self-sufficient. He begets not, neither is he begotten. There's none comparable to him. There's all kinds of problems with that surah. But one problem is that phrase that I cited as self-sufficient. If you look up, there's a good website online called IslamAwakened.com. If you look up that verse in IslamAwakened.com, it'll give you 70 different English translations. And when you look through those 70 translations, you'll notice there's an incredible number of variation. They can't agree on how to translate it. And I'm going to tell you why they can't agree. Imagine if I told you, or if I asked you a question, let's say I'm giving you a math test, and I say, what's the answer to 2 plus 2? And I say, before you answer, you can't say 4. 4 is not one of the possible answers. Now, you're going to give all kinds of different answers because people are going to come up with different answers because none of them really work, and so everybody's going to be taking their best shot at it, right? 2 sounds the most, or 3 sounds better than 2. Somebody else might say 5 sounds better than 3, right? 5 is, we can't say 4, so what's the better option, right? This is the kind of thing that's going on with the translators. The actual meaning of the passage is ruled out in advance because it's not consistent with the propaganda. So, here's the backstory about this surah. Somebody, the pagans came to Muhammad one day, and you have to remember, these are pagans. Muhammad was born in a pagan context, surrounded by pagans. His family, his tribe, according to the Islamic sources, they were responsible for taking care of the Kaaba. So he was entrenched, according to their narratives, he was entrenched in these pagan modes of worship and ways of thinking. Well, one day a group of pagans came to Muhammad and they asked Muhammad, what is your God made out of? What does he consist of? They're asking, you know, they have these idols of wood and precious stones. And I mean, I don't know all the different materials in the case of the gods that surrounded the Kaaba at the time, but that's just standard fare in ancient times, that they would construct these things out of various solid substances. And so they're asking Muhammad, basically, if their God, his God, is like that. The word that Muhammad uses here in the Quran, when it's translated in some cases self-sufficient, is the word samad. Samad. Which, if you look at the lexicons of the Arabic language. In fact, if you look at Al-Tabari, who's one of their foremost commentators, he gives you a chain going back to the time of Muhammad and his companions. He gives you various chains which are supposed to tell you what this word means. And the chain that goes back to Muhammad says that the word means solid. So when Muhammad is answering the pagans, he's saying Allah is solid. as opposed to hollow. Okay, because some of these deities would be hollow, but Muhammad is saying his deity is solid. Now here's a narration, and this is where it gets good. There's a narration that Al-Tabari tells that is related to this. It's not necessarily in the same spot of the of his commentary, but you can see the connection. You'll catch it in a moment. We're told, according to Al-Tabari, and there are many narrations like this, that Allah created Adam as a lifeless statue at first. He created him, and he caused him to stand erect, and he stood there as a lifeless statue for 40 years before he breathed life into this statue. Well, one day, a group of angels happens upon this statue, and they're alarmed. Now, why would a group of angels be afraid of a statue? You ever been afraid of a statue? Maybe as a kid. Maybe a statue was an alarming thing. But these are angels, mighty angels. They come upon this statue, and suddenly they're alarmed. Something has alarmed them about this statue. Well, then Satan comes along, and basically, this is my paraphrase, basically says, what are you guys alarmed at, fellas? You know, what's the problem here? He says, I'm going to go over there and investigate, and I'll come back, and I'll let you know if your fears are justified. So basically, Satan's going to go over and do some detective work. He's going to figure out whether they're alarmed for good reason. What Satan does when he goes over to this statue is he enters in through its mouth, and then he goes out through its rear, and he comes back to the angels, and he says, don't worry, fellas. He says, that is hollow, but your Lord is Samad, solid. Can you now understand what the angels were possibly alarmed at? What did they think that statue was? They thought the statue was Allah. It looked like Allah. And so when they see this statue, they're afraid. They think it's Allah. But Satan goes over to the statue, and by virtue of being able to enter through its mouth and go out through its rear, he knew that it wasn't Allah, because Allah is solid. Now, this gave rise, and these are absurdities that has never entered into the mind of any Christian, whom Muslims are telling we've got this complicated doctrine and all the rest. This gave rise to debate among Muslims who were trying to figure out how much of Allah is solid, because it can't be the case that he's completely solid, because Allah speaks. So there has to be, according to them, a chest cavity. So there were certain Muslims who said that Allah is solid from the stomach down. Then there were other Muslims who said, no, he's solid from the waist down. Okay. And this was given as the explanation. I wish I was making this stuff up. I don't have any special pleasure in making all this look dumb. If you now put this back into Surah 112, it says Allah doesn't beget, neither is he begotten. Why doesn't he beget? Because he's solid, right? There's no ability to beget, because he's at least solid from the waist down, according to Islamic theology. This is what it says in those stories. Now, a lot of Muslims don't know all these stories, but there are Muslims today who do very much believe that the Quran, when it describes Allah and it assigns parts to him, they take that literally. And this is one of the many disputes among modern-day Muslims. Now, when I first started reading the Quran, I told some of you before, I first started reading the Quran because I was interacting with members of the Nation of Islam. And I knew this wasn't Orthodox Islam, so I wanted to use this against that. I wanted to say, you guys aren't even following Islam. And so I became familiar with the Quran before I actually started engaging ordinary Muslims. When I first met certain Muslims, I remember being shocked at the sorts of things they believed, because I thought, that's not how I read the Quran. The Quran seems to me to be saying something very different. So, for example, does the Quran teach that the Bible's been corrupted? I never once had that impression. I read the Quran over and over again so I could deal with these guys, and when I went and talked to Orthodox Muslims, I was shocked to hear that they thought the Bible was corrupted. I thought, that's nowhere in the Quran. The Bible's the Quran's favorite book. Well, there were all kinds of things that I was shocked by. When I started reading the Quran, and before I talked to Muslims, I came to the conclusion that the Quran had an anthropomorphic conception of Allah. So I've got a few minutes left. I just want to give you one very clear example. It also involves Satan. Satan is constantly exposing the Allah of the Quran for what he really is. In the Quran, there's a story, it's told numerous times. When Allah created Adam, he told the angels to prostrate to it. Now you can understand, if Adam looks like Allah, you could almost see why this might make some sense. But that's, in any case, the matter of fact that Allah commands the angels to prostrate to Adam. In Orthodox theology, you're not supposed to bow down to anything other than Allah. It's shirk. But Allah himself commanded the angels to bow down to Adam. There was one who objected and said he wouldn't do it, and it's Satan, Iblis in the Quran. When Allah comes to Satan and upbraids him for refusing to bow down to Adam, Allah says, "Why did you refuse to bow down to the one that I created with my own two hands?" Now, as a Christian, when I first read that, I thought, oh, that's just a figure of speech. The Bible uses figures of speech, right? I could say, I gave somebody a hand writing a paper, and that doesn't necessarily mean I used my hand. Maybe I'm just verbalizing something. There are figures of speech. The Bible uses figures of speech. And initially, when I was reading the Quran, that's what I was predisposed to think, that the Quran was like this. But the more I thought about it, the more I read it, the more the Quran made it very impossible for me to accept this. Because I want you to think this through. The way that Muslims will sometimes respond to this is they'll say, when it says Allah created Adam with his hands, it's just an idiom for his power. And I was predisposed to think this because I read the Bible, and the Bible uses idioms. But I want you to think this through with me for a moment. Allah is telling the angels to bow down to Adam. Not everything, to Adam. And the reason they're supposed to bow down to Adam and not everything, Adam in particular, is because he was made with Allah's two hands. If that's the rationale, if that's the grounding for why you're supposed to prostrate to Adam, and it's just an idiom for how God created everything, then there's no reason you should bow down to Adam as opposed to everything else. Right? Everything would be a proper object of prostration. So I started thinking, wait a minute, maybe the Quran really does mean that Allah has hands. There's another story in the Quran where it talks about Allah stroking Adam's, or it mentions him bringing Adam's progeny out from him. Before we were ever born, he brought out all of Adam's descendants and made us confess that he's the true God. And then he put us all back in the loins of Adam. That's why Muslims will say, when somebody becomes a Muslim, that they're reverting. Because they were born Muslims, they left Islam, and now they're coming back. Because you were a Muslim before you were ever born. That's why I always say, Muslims sometimes say that Islam's the fastest growing religion. And I say, well, not on your own account it isn't. There's over 7 billion, I don't know what the current figure is, there's over 7 billion people on the planet today, and at least 5 billion of them are not Muslims. So if they were all born Muslims, then at least 5 billion people have left Islam. Islam is the fastest shrinking religion on the planet. I don't know any religion that's lost more of its members than Islam. But according to the hadith, Allah did this by stroking Adam's back and bringing out his progeny. Now, in order to understand why he strokes his back, you have to know that the Quran says that semen proceeds from between the backbone and the ribs. So this is why Allah strokes Adam's back and brings out his progeny. But notice, he strokes his back with his right hand, according to the hadith. In a famous hadith, and I'll conclude with this, there's a famous hadith. Every Muslim should know this. It's known as the hadith of intercession. And it's a hadith that is talking about people standing on this open plain. All the people from all of history are going to stand on this open plain for around 50,000 years, awaiting judgment. The sun's going to be beating down on people, and by the way, everyone's going to be naked. So I always smart from this one. Muslims pretend that theirs is a modest religion. They have their women cover up and so forth. But men, women, children, everybody's going to be standing on this plain naked for 50,000 years. Doesn't seem very modest to me. In any case, they're going to be standing there for 50,000 years, and they're going to get anxious waiting the impending judgment. They want the day to come and everything to be finalized. And so they begin to think, who can we go to usher things on and get us a favorable response from Allah? And so they start thinking who they can go to, and they begin to think of prominent people, the prophets. So the first person they go to is Adam. They go to Adam, who is the father of mankind. I'm going to skip over something, but I just hold on to this idea that they're going to prominent individuals. They go to Adam, and Adam says, "Don't come to me. I sinned against my Lord, and he's angrier now than I've ever seen him before. Go to Noah." Then Noah's going to say, "Don't come to me. I sinned against my Lord. He's angrier than I've ever seen him before. Go to Abraham." Abraham's going to say the same thing. Go to Moses. Moses is going to say, "Go to David." David's going to say the same thing, and he's going to say, "Go to Jesus." Now, here's an interesting little aside. When Jesus directs them away from himself, according to the hadith, he doesn't say he sinned or that God is angry with him. There's nothing said there. He just says, "Go to Muhammad." So that's where it ends, is they go to Muhammad, and he's supposedly able to intercede with Allah for them. But it does say that he sinned too, but Allah forgave his sins. But here's the thing I skipped over. The reason they're going to these individuals is because they're prominent prophets, and each person has something special that distinguishes him from everybody else. Who knows what's special about Moses that distinguishes him from everybody else, according to the Islamic sources? It says that Allah spoke to him directly. That's why Moses is so special. Why is Abraham so special? Abraham's special because he was called the friend of God. They get some of this right. He's called the friend of God. Nobody else? What about Jesus? This is, again, startling. Muslims don't know what to do with this. They go to Jesus because he's the Word of God and his Spirit. What is that all about? Jesus is called Allah's Word and his Spirit from him? I don't have time to go into that. But you get the point. They're going to these individuals because there's something special or unique about them. Why do you think they went to Adam? What's special about Adam? I can't hear what you guys said, but the answer is he was made with Allah's two hands. That's what made Adam special. He was made with Allah's two hands. So when God upbraids Satan in Surah 38:75 for not bowing down to the one he created with his two hands, it's intended literally. Allah is viewed as having literal hands, according to the pagan Arabs or whoever produced the Quran. The God of Islam is not absolutely one. This isn't simple. I think you can see it's also quite absurd. But the Muslims get away with this because they keep repeating it, and Christians don't know how to respond and challenge them on it. So I would encourage you, as you engage Muslims, to think through this sort of thing more thoroughly, because you'll encounter this. You're going to encounter Muslims who will just keep insisting that these things are so, even though they're not. I'll conclude with that.